If you're a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility and your machinery isn't working right, Grainger knows you need to understand what's wrong as soon as possible. So when a conveyor motor falters, Grainger offers diagnostic tools like calibration kits and multimeters to help you identify and fix the problem. With Grainger, you can be confident you have everything you need to keep your facility running smoothly. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Listener, did you know there's an online cannabis company that ships federally legal THC right to your door? And they found a way to combine THC with carefully selected functional ingredients to target nearly every mood and health concern that you can think of. I'm talking about Mood.com's incredible line of functional gummies. Forget one-size-fits-all supplements that only get you high. Mood's functional gummies are optimized to kick in as little as 15 minutes and take you to the mood you're looking for. Whether that's mind magic gummies for deep work and creativity, PMS support to ease cramps and balance mood swings, or their sexual euphoria gummies to help you feel ready for action and turn every touch into a full body experience. Listen, you can find gummies to just get you high pretty much anywhere these days. But Mood's functional gummies combine premium, federally legal THC with targeted botanicals to help you get to the perfect mood. Best of all, not only is every Mood product backed by a 100-day satisfaction guarantee, listeners get 20% off their first order with code Obscura. Head to Mood.com, find your functional gummy that matches exactly what you're looking for, and let Mood help you discover your perfect mood. And don't forget to use promo code Obscura when you check out to save 20% off your first order. Listener, Obscura is supported by listeners like yourself. My Patreon is only $3. That's less than the cup of coffee. And if 10% of listeners join the Patreon, that would be a life-changing amount of money. I'm an indie creator, and I rely on listeners like you. But sometimes, I'm not so good at creating calls to action. I can feel a little self-conscious about it. Now, what you get on the Patreon is hundreds of hours worth of bonus content. From Black Label episodes, Obscura episodes, and fireside chats you can't find on the main feed. If you want access to that, head to patreon.com/obscuracrimepodcast. That's patreon.com/obscuracrimepodcast. And hey, if you can't afford it, I understand. Don't put yourself in jeopardy. Listening is enough. All right, let's get on with it.
Welcome, listener. I'm glad you're here. Take a seat next to the fire.
Welcome to Obscura, where we shine a light on the dark.
Jones was born on February 28, 1951, to her parents, Bob and Joanne, in Havana, in the state of Illinois. Deborah was born 19 months after older sister Pamela. From a young age, it was clear to both Deborah's teachers and her family that her level of academic aptitude far exceeded that of her classmates. Her talents extended to the piano and violin. She loved to read novels and was a natural when it came to athletic pursuits like tennis and soccer. Following the family relocating due to Bob's work, Deborah started attending Metamora Township High School in Illinois. In Deborah's junior year of high school, the family relocated again, this time to a farming community near Peora, where Deborah attended Peora Central High School. Far from being a typical awkward teen who had trouble making friends as a new student, Deborah had no trouble fitting in at her new high school environment. She developed a reputation as someone with quick wit, becoming a cheerleader, serving on the student council, and joining the choir and the French club. Deborah's IQ of 165 and her perfect GPA made it clear to her peers and teachers that she was someone who was going places. So it came as no surprise that when Deborah graduated high school, she was named as both a National Merit Scholar and co-valedictorian of her class. In 1969, 18-year-old Deborah started attending the University of Illinois, where she majored in chemistry. She eventually broke up with her high school sweetheart but it wasn't long until she met and started dating an engineering student named Dwayne Green. In terms of her future career aspirations, Deborah's first passion was chemical engineering, but when she graduated college in 1972, she found herself reconsidering her chosen career path. The competition for jobs within the chemical engineering sector at the time was tough, so Deborah reevaluated her options. Deborah and Dwayne married in 1974, and Deborah decided to enroll in medical school. She graduated from the University of Kansas School of Medicine in 1975 at age 24. Always the go-getter, Deborah chose the high-pressure, fast-paced specialty of emergency medicine. By the time she was undertaking her residency, Deborah and Dwayne had moved to the city of Independence in the nearby state of Missouri. Newlywed bliss wouldn't last long, though, and by 1978, the couple had divorced. In the book, Bitter Harvest by late author Ann Rule, it was reported that Deborah and Dwayne's split was believed to be amicable, but a year before the divorce was finalized, Deborah had already met somebody else. 23-year-old Michael Farrar was a talented medical student with a bright future. Even though he was 4 years Deborah's junior, Michael was attracted to her drive and intelligence, and Deborah felt secure in her new relationship with someone she felt was a reliable partner. The pair married in May 1979, but Michael later stated that the relationship wasn't one of typical newlyweds, and that neither he nor Deborah ever expressed their love for each other verbally. Much to Michael's disappointment, Deborah showed no interest in getting to know Michael's family, nor spending quality time with her new in-laws. Michael also harbored concerns about his bride's temper, which at times could be volatile and unpredictable, but her ambition and passion to succeed was energizing. Following Michael's graduation from medical school at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, he and Deborah moved to Ohio, where Michael commenced a 3-year residency in internal medicine at the University of Cincinnati. Deborah continued to work as an emergency physician, but she soon tired of the specialty and decided to join Michael in his internal medicine residency. It was following the couple's move to Ohio that Deborah's health started to suffer. She required surgery on an infected wrist and also experienced crippling migraines as well as insomnia. Despite these medical issues, Deborah and Michael welcomed their first child, Tim, into the world on January 20th, 1982. 31-year-old Deborah wasted no time getting back to work following the birth and employed a nanny to help look after Tim after taking 6 weeks maternity leave. By this stage of her career, Deborah was undertaking a fellowship in hematology and oncology, but again took maternity leave 2 years later for the birth of the couple's second child, Kate, in 1984. Deborah completed her fellowship and opened her own practice in 1985. Michael, too, was in the final stages of his fellowship in cardiology, which he completed in 1986. It was that same year that the Farrar family moved back to Missouri, putting down roots in Kansas City. The Salina Journal newspaper reported that from 1986 to 1994, the couple worked at Trinity Lutheran Hospital, with Michael also working at North Kansas City Hospital. Feeling established, Deborah opened a private practice during this period, but much to her disappointment, the hospital her practice was attached to suddenly closed, and she found herself pregnant for a third time. The pregnancy was an unexpected surprise, but Michael was thrilled about the impending arrival of another child. However, for Deborah, this was not part of the plan, and she resented her dreams of pursuing a private practice being put on hold long term. On December 13, 1988, the couple's second daughter and third child, Kelly, was born. But 37-year-old Deborah struggled in the postpartum period and found her levels of self-esteem plummeting as she struggled to lose the baby weight following her pregnancy with Kelly. Despite this challenge and no longer working in a private practice, Deborah came to find a new identity in motherhood and went that extra mile to ensure that every birthday and the holidays were memorable for her children. Michael later remembered his wife as nothing less than a dedicated mother to their young family. Deborah and Michael's professional and financial success meant they were able to afford not only the best education for their children, but also nannies to help the household run smoothly. The kids attended a private school in Kansas City, where all manner of extracurricular activities and opportunities were available. Tim was passionate about sports, especially soccer and ice hockey. He also loved to cook and had a strong social conscience. Sticking up for other kids at school, were targeted by bullies. Kate was a talented ballet dancer, and by the time she was 10 years old, was performing with the State Ballet of Missouri. Kelly had inherited her mother's love of reading, and all three children took swimming and tennis lessons. Deborah had been an animal lover all her life. Much to her children's delight, the family adopted a black Labrador named Boomer, who slept in the children's bedrooms. There were mixed reports from other parents at the children's school about Deborah's involvement in her kids' lives. Some said she was nothing less than encouraging, but to others, she appeared overbearing and critical of her children's performance. A nanny who worked for the family later recalled that on one occasion, Deborah told her, "I didn't want kids. I never had. I'm just doing it for Mike." But despite being in a position to afford private schooling and activities for her children, Deborah's work suffered when her health issues returned. Up until 1989, she continued to work at Trinity Lutheran Hospital, till she eventually made the difficult decision to stop full-time work. Instead, she would work part-time from the family home, which would also allow her to be more involved in her children's education and after-school activities. Deborah and Mike hired a new nanny who would stay with the family for the next 4 years, but it was a big change for Deborah academically. She was no longer in the thick of work she found challenging and engaging. Instead, working on medical peer reviews and processing Medicaid claims. For Deborah, the work was dull and uninspiring, and it didn't go unnoticed amongst her former colleagues, who had always described Deborah as having a terrible bedside manner when it came to her interactions with patients, which were unempathetic to say the least. It was also around this time that Deborah's behavior towards Michael appeared to shift. Gone was the supportive wife who had once found her husband dependable. In her place was a woman who had instead become suspicious and obsessive about her husband, who started working longer hours in an attempt to escape the tension at home. In an effort to dull the chronic physical pain she was experiencing, 38-year-old Deborah started self-medicating with an array of sedatives and narcotics, some of which were prescribed illegally. This continued for the next several years and affected her moods, coping skills, and ability to contribute equally to household tasks such as cooking and cleaning, to such a degree that Michael confronted his wife on several occasions. Deborah would eventually agree that it wasn't a healthy way to manage her pain long term, and assured her husband that she would stop being over-reliant on prescription medication. But Deborah's temper was still proving unpredictable. The book Bitter Harvest details how, irrespective of whether she was in the family home, a professional setting with patients and colleagues, or a crowded shopping mall, Deborah's angry outbursts started to see her destroy things and even harm herself. By the early 90s, Deborah was also involving the children in her arguments with Michael, venting her frustrations with their father in the process, manipulating the kids in such a way that they turned against him. Their eldest child, Tim, was so angry with his father that their relationship became fraught, with the usual parent-teacher disagreements escalating to physical confrontations. The Manhattan Mercury newspaper later reported that on one occasion, Michael knocked him to the ground during an argument, and on another, pushed him into a wall. By early 1994, 38-year-old Michael had had enough. In January, he told Deborah he wanted a divorce, and to say that she didn't take it well is an understatement. Deborah lashed out at Michael, becoming physically violent, causing him to move out of the family home and into an apartment. The children would stay with Deborah, and even though things were bad between her and Michael, they agreed at the time to share custody of the kids. With Michael out of the house, this provided a respite from the constant strain between husband and wife, and the temporary abatement of tension provided some hope that cooler heads would prevail. Michael and Deborah maintained contact in an effort to rectify things. Both agreed to a fresh start as a family unit by moving into a bigger house. In May 1994, the couple set their sights on purchasing a six-bedroom home located in the affluent suburb of Prairie Village, across the state line in Kansas. However, Michael started to have second thoughts, and the sale fell through when he realized that such a financial commitment would mean in the face of trying to save a marriage which was hanging by a thread. The prospect of the couple getting into even more debt wasn't something that sat comfortably with Michael and went against his better judgment. It wasn't long after Deborah and Michael's plans to move were canceled that the family suffered another blow. On May 21st, 1994, while the family was out, their existing home caught fire. The cause was identified as accidental, thanks to an electrical fault from a power cord. The house sustained significant damage, but thankfully, the financial impact of repairing the home and replacing the family's damaged belongings was absorbed by the insurance payout. This prompted Deborah and Michael to reconsider the aborted purchase of the home in Prairie Village. And in the interim, Deborah and the children moved into Michael's apartment that he had been renting during the separation, with the purchase of the $400,000 Prairie home finalized in June 1994. The family moved in addition to 18 rooms, a pool, 4-car garage, and a jacuzzi. The 3-level, 5,000-square-foot Tudor-style home also boasted an intercom system. The master bedroom was situated on ground level, while the children's bedroom and bathroom occupied the second story. Prairie Village was home to high flyers and people who had succeeded in their fields, and the palatial size of the homes in the area reflected this. Deborah felt like she was finally home, amongst people as successful as she was. This was somewhere that she and Michael could finally get their marriage back on track. For a brief period, 43-year-old Deborah seemed to do a complete 180 when it came to homemaking responsibilities, putting increased effort into cooking meals and being house proud. Michael also took the opportunity as a wake-up call when it came to maintaining a better work-life balance. He cut back on his hours at work to allow him to focus on his marriage and family. But despite the lifestyle changes, the couple made an attempt to patch up their failing marriage. Their newfound happiness was short-lived. By the end of 1994, the couple were back to square one and arguing just as much, if not more. The one remaining chance of salvaging the marriage was their family vacation to Peru, scheduled for June 1995 in conjunction with a school trip for Tim. For Michael, this would be the make-or-break litmus test for the relationship.
Listener, we all wish we had more ways to save more. Chime understands that every dollar counts. That's why, when you set up direct deposit through Chime, you get access to fee-free features like fee overdraft coverage, getting paid up to 2 days early with direct deposit, and more. Chime is banking done right. Open a checking account with no monthly fees and no maintenance fees. Get paid up to 2 days early when you set up direct deposit. With qualifying direct deposits, you're eligible for free overdraft up to $200 on debit card purchases and cash withdrawals. Today, Chime has spotted members over $30 billion. Open a checking account with no monthly fees and no maintenance fees, not to mention access to over 47,000 fee-free ATMs, more than the top 3 national banks combined. My younger self would have loved Chime. Work on your financial goals through Chime today. Open an account in 2 minutes at chime.com/obscura. That's chime.com/obscura. Chime feels like progress.
Chime is a financial technology company, not a bank. Banking services and debit card provided by the Bancorp Bank N.A. or Stride Bank N.A. Members FDIC. Spot me eligibility requirements and overdraft limits apply. Timing depends on submission of payment file. Fees apply at out-of-network ATMs. Bank ranking and number of ATMs according to U.S. News & World Report 2023. Chime checking account required.
Obscura is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Fiscally responsible, financial geniuses, monetary magicians. These are things people say about drivers who switch their car insurance to Progressive and save hundreds. Because Progressive offers discounts for paying in full, owning a home, and more. Plus, you can count on their great customer service to help when you need it. So, your dollar goes a long way. Visit Progressive.com to see if you could save on car insurance. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Potential savings will vary. Not available in all states or situations.
It was while on vacation in Peru that Michael met another parent whose child attended the same school as the Farrar children, who had come on the school trip to chaperone. Like Michael and Deborah, Margaret Hacker and her husband also worked in the medical sector, and the couple had 2 children. Margaret worked as a registered nurse, while her husband was an anesthesiologist. The more Michael got to know Margaret over the course of the trip, it was revealed that she too was in an unhappy marriage, and the attraction between Michael and Margaret was undeniable. Upon returning from Peru, Michael and Margaret continued to spend time together, and it wasn't long before the pair were having an affair. Michael knew there was no future for him and Deborah, and in late July 1995, he asked her for a divorce. Not one to take such an announcement lying down, Deborah was distraught and told the children their father was abandoning them. During this time, Deborah continued to drink heavily, and following Michael's decision, Deborah's level of alcohol consumption increased dramatically, and she often drank until she passed out. Given that Deborah continued to drive their kids to and from school and their extracurricular activities, Michael was so concerned about his wife's level of alcohol intake that he decided to continue to live in the family home to ensure his children were safe and appropriately supervised. Deborah's failure to maintain housework and meal preparation tasks meant that 13-year-old Tim was doing the majority of the cooking. Deborah's ongoing heavy drinking saw her continue to spiral out of control. On August 4th, she called Michael at work, telling him she was walking along the busy city roads in the hope that she'd be hit and killed by a car. When Michael raced around to the house, he searched every corner. Deborah eventually called Michael and told him she'd been hiding in the basement the whole time, and that she wanted to make him worry about her. On August 11th, 1995, Michael suddenly fell ill with gastrointestinal symptoms, including nausea, vomiting, and diarrhea. Given the family had just returned from Peru, Michael wrote off his symptoms as that of a lingering stomach bug that most of the group on the school trip had contracted. Just when it seemed Michael was about to make a full recovery, a week after the onset of his symptoms, his condition deteriorated. On August 18th, Michael was admitted to a hospital, suffering from severe dehydration, weight loss, and fever, and doctors considered his condition life-threatening. During his admission, Michael developed sepsis, which arose from bacteria leaking through his perforated gastrointestinal tract. Despite confirming the origin of the infection, doctors failed to identify the actual cause, which was unable to be attributed to a parasite or any specific tropical disease. A week later, Michael was discharged from the hospital, having made a significant recovery. But that same night, the symptoms returned, and he was readmitted. The only thing Michael had consumed was the evening meal, which was served by Deborah, but could have been fixed by Tim, who was also doing most of the household cooking. Michael couldn't work out why he couldn't seem to shake the illness. Perhaps it was aggravated by trying to return to his usual diet too soon. Michael was discharged from his second hospital admission on August 30th, but on September 4th, he again fell ill for a third time and returned to the hospital, where he would stay for another week. Doctors are now convinced that the cause of Michael's reoccurring symptoms was contracted in Peru. The problem was that none of Michael's debilitating symptoms seemed to fit precisely with any one diagnosis. In the absence of any drastic dietary changes, Michael looked to psychosomatic factors in an effort to identify the cause of his illness. Given that his symptoms returned almost immediately upon being discharged and into Deborah's care on each occasion, he assumed it must have been due to stress and anxiety he was experiencing as his marriage crumbled. But then another theory was given to Michael, which blindsided him. His new partner, Margaret, whom he had met on the Peru school trip, suggested that Deborah was poisoning her husband. The whole idea was too preposterous to be true, but as outrageous as the proposition was, the seeds of doubt had been planted into Michael's mind. The common precursor to all of Michael's hospitalizations was that he ate food that he'd been served by Deborah. Michael continued to turn over in his mind the possibility that Deborah wanted to seriously harm or even kill him. By late September 1995, Michael decided to search the house to see if there was any truth to Margaret's suggestion that Deborah was trying to poison her husband. When Michael went through Deborah's purse, he found a copy of a letter that he'd previously received from an anonymous author, asking him to reconsider the divorce. He also found empty vials of potassium chloride, multiple packets of seeds which the packaging indicated as castor beans, empty syringes, and a receipt from an early May garden center in Olathe, dated August 7th that same year. Michael decided to take the unusual items from Deborah's purse and hide them for safekeeping. On September 25th, he approached Deborah about her plans for the castor beans. Michael knew that Deborah didn't have her green thumb, so when she told him she was intending to plant the seeds, he didn't believe her. Deborah eventually admitted that she was planning to use the seeds to take her own life. Immediately following the conversation with Michael about the castor beans, Deborah started drinking heavily and continued throughout the day. Michael became so concerned about her behavior and his kid's welfare that he called the police. When law enforcement arrived at the home, officers found Deborah drunk in bed. Michael told the officers he feared his wife was suicidal. But upon hearing this, Deborah began verbally abusing and cursing at Michael. When she showed police the items he'd found in Deborah's purse, they decided it was best to take her to the nearest hospital for assessment. When Deborah was examined, it was noted that she smelled of alcohol and appeared disheveled. After speaking with Deborah, the emergency room doctor documented that despite her appearance, she was coping the best she could, given her marriage was falling apart in acrimonious fashion. Deborah told the doctor she had no intention to self-harm or hurt anyone else. And the assessment was progressing well until Michael arrived at the hospital. When Deborah spotted him, she lashed out, spat at him, and called him a fuckhole, screaming, "You're gonna get these kids over our dead bodies." After staff managed to subdue Deborah, she agreed that being voluntarily committed would be beneficial in terms of monitoring her mental health. But soon after, Deborah couldn't be found anywhere on the hospital grounds. When she was finally located, she decided to walk home from the hospital. She was still in agreement about voluntary admission and was taken to a hospital in Topeka. It was here that Deborah was diagnosed with major bipolar depression with suicidal impulses and prescribed various medications. After only a short stay of 4 days, Deborah was discharged. Meanwhile, Michael had used the brief respite at home as an opportunity to research information about castor beans. What he found out not only chilled him to the bone, but turned his stomach. Castor beans, which grow on the castor plant, are the source of a naturally occurring but deadly chemical called ricin. Thanks to popular culture, ricin is most commonly known as a biowarfare agent. When the pulp of the castor bean is ingested, even in minuscule quantities, ricin attacks the cells that line the gastrointestinal tract, including the esophagus, stomach, and small and large intestine, causing ulceration. Symptoms include rapid dehydration, severe abdominal pain, low blood pressure, and an increased heart rate. It was no wonder Michael's symptoms returned with a vengeance every time he'd return home from the hospital into Deborah's care. As much as he could never have imagined it, Michael knew that Deborah was using the beans to poison his food. Despite making the heart-wrenching decision to leave his children, Michael now held grave fears for his safety. Things didn't improve for Deborah following her return home, and she continued to act in a bizarre manner and drank heavily, prompting Michael to move out of the family home for good on October 5th, in what was surely an attempt to console the kids, or perhaps herself, in the wake of Michael's departure. Deborah adopted a greyhound named Russell, but the acquisition of a new pet didn't seem to placate the fragile situation in the family home. Deborah was still angry with Michael, and in fits of rage and drunkenness, belligerently lectured the children about how their father had abandoned them all to be with Margaret, claiming he cared more about his new girlfriend than his own kids. October 23, 1995 was the first day of a brief home-based vacation for Michael Farrar. Only a month earlier, he'd been discharged from his third hospital admission for acute gastrointestinal symptoms, and he was easing back into work due to the physically debilitating nature of his illness. Michael spent the afternoon with Margaret, then later picked up Tim and Kelly to go to a hockey game Tim was playing. Following the game, Michael dropped Tim and Kelly off at home at approximately 8:45 p.m. Michael then had dinner with his girlfriend Margaret, during which time he received two calls on his pager. Just before he drove back to his apartment at around 11:30 p.m., he received a third call. The calls were from Deborah, whom he spoke to when he arrived home, but soon got into an argument. Michael had had enough of Deborah's heavy drinking and irresponsible behavior, especially considering she was the children's primary caregiver. Michael accused Deborah of poisoning him, and he threatened to contact social services to intervene. When the phone call ended abruptly, Michael continued to watch television to try and unwind from the heated confrontation. At 20 minutes after midnight, on October 24, 1995, a 911 call was made from the family home. The nature of the emergency wasn't clear, as the caller hung up the phone without speaking. Police were dispatched to the address, and when they arrived, they found the home ablaze. When firefighters arrived minutes later, they found Deborah and 10-year-old Kate outside the house. But 13-year-old Tim and 6-year-old Kelly were still inside. A distraught Kate had no idea why her siblings hadn't managed to escape and was inconsolable. She begged firefighters to save her siblings, who were still trapped inside the house and unaccounted for. In contrast, firefighters and officers on the scene noted that Deborah appeared to be very calm and cool. Of course, it was entirely possible that Deborah was in shock, having narrowly escaped with her life and was watching on helplessly, not knowing the fate of her other children. At 12:30 a.m., the phone rang at Michael's apartment, where he was still watching TV. A neighbor who lived next door to Deborah and the kids was on the line and frantically relayed that there was a fire at the house. A panicked and confused Michael jumped in the car and immediately drove over. By the time he arrived, firefighters had made their way inside the home, but were prevented from conducting a thorough search due to the ferocity of the flames that were rapidly consuming the dwelling. With the home at risk of collapse due to the intense heat and high winds that were hampering their efforts due to the fire spreading, firefighters were forced to abandon their effort to search for Tim and Kelly. When Michael arrived at the scene, he initially thought that all the children had escaped. It wasn't until some time later that a new and horrifying reality would dawn on the unsuspecting father. As fire crews fought to bring the roaring flames under control, the level of destruction to what had once been the family's dream home was clear. The house was gutted, with irreparable structural damage to the wooden frame, not just from the flames, but smoke and water. The only thing left standing was the garage. The stonework around the front entryway of the house had created a gaping facade, like a grotesque yawn, framing the smoldering remnants behind.